1978, the Mormons claimed a new revelation. It was their first real revelation since 1847. I am John L. Smith. I served for 17 years in Utah as a Baptist pastor and in other capacities. For the past 12 years or so, we've been traveling over this nation speaking in colleges, churches, and seminaries on the subject of Mormonism. As you may know, Mormonism has been growing at a tremendous rate. It grows because people do not know what it is. I would like to have you write to me if you would like further information on this subject. Our address is John L. Smith, Box 47, Marlow, spelled M-A-R-L-O-W, Marlow, Oklahoma. That's zip code 73055. On a Friday, June the 9th, 1978, the Mormons claimed a new revelation, the first real revelation since 1847. Of course, there had been the revelation on polygamy, which was dated 1843, but not publicly announced until 1852. And there had been the manifesto, which was not really proclaimed as a revelation, and it was noticeably ambiguous, especially in view of the fact that nothing was really revealed. Only advice was given that they refrain from contracting any marriage forbidden by the law of the land, and no change in Mormon doctrine was intended at all. They still believe in polygamy and still practice it and intend to practice it in heaven. Though the Mormon Church says we are not practicing it here on earth today, it is being practiced in Utah by more people than during the days of Brigham Young, with the willful disregard for the law by the current Utah state government. I should mention that there were a couple of belatedly professed revelations dated 1836 and 1918, but these were proclaimed in April 1976. It is interesting, too, that these two revelations were placed at the end of the Pearl of Great Price and not in the Doctrine and Covenants, as were all former revelations. Therefore, Mormons and students of Mormonism were interested when, for the first time in 121 years, a really new revelation was received and immediately proclaimed. We might note that the past 10 Mormon presidents have not received revelations worthy of being included in the Doctrine and Covenants. On June 9, 1978, only hours after the jury in Las Vegas had rendered their verdict stating that the so-called Mormon will was a fraud, LDS prophet and seer Spencer W. Kimball stunned the Mormon world with his announcement that as he was praying in the Salt Lake Temple, God revealed to him that the Negro could now receive the LDS priesthood. We should note that this in no way compares with the priesthood of the Old Testament or with the priesthood as understood by Catholics, nor does it compare with the priesthood as is taught in the New Testament. The Mormon priesthood, held by nearly 1 million of their 4 million members, had now become available to blacks. Any study of the Mormon revelation relating to Negroes being allowed to be ordained to be priests in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints must of necessity be preceded by some information on previous Mormon teachings about the black man. The Book of Mormon speaks of a people who turned black because of their wickedness and those who became white again when they became good. You will find those passages in 1 Nephi chapter 12, verse 23, in Alma chapter 3 and verse 6, and in 3 Nephi chapter 2 and verse 15, as well as in many other passages. But Mormon leaders have been vehement in their harsh denunciations of the black or Negro race. Brigham Young said that any man having one drop of the seed of Cain, the Negro, in him, cannot receive the priesthood. He also said if one mixes his seed, if he marries with and produces children with one of the Negro race, that he should be killed on the spot. Brigham Young said that the Lord had put a curse upon him, which is the flat nose and the black skin. You'll find that in the Journal of Discourses, volume 7 and verse 290, page 290. He said that they cannot rise above the position of a servant in the Journal of Discourses, volume 10 and page 190. Smith, Young, John Taylor, George A. Smith, and many other leading Mormons spoke publicly, and their sayings were printed, in which they referred to blacks as niggers. Their scriptures, the Pearl of Great Price says, a blackness came upon all the children of Canaan, and they were despised among all people. Even many Mormon leaders have made strong statements recently upholding the Mormon teaching about the blacks. Joseph Fielding Smith, president of the LDS Church until his death in 1972, spoke of the blacks as being of an inferior race. He said that blacks could not be ordained to the priesthood because they are the children of Cain, whom God cursed and marked with a black skin for killing his brother Abel. I should note here that Mormons believe that we live before we were born, and that those living exemplary lives were born white. Those not so good had to be born dark-skinned, but that Negroes, they have had various ideas as to why they're black. It may have been, some say, because of some wrong that they did, or it may have been that they just were not valiant. But anyway, in order to take a body, they had to take a body from a black parent. So they believe that Negroes were forced to be born black, unable to hold the priesthood, unable to be married in the temple, unable to serve as Mormon missionaries, unable to serve as a Mormon bishop, or otherwise benefit from the Mormon priesthood that other men were allowed to hold. Not only Joseph Fielding Smith, but David O. McKay and Alvin R. Dyer and Bruce R. McConkie and even Mark E. Peterson have made rather recent statements further painting themselves into a corner and burning the bridges behind them, making a new revelation all the more difficult to accept. I should mention that Mormons have long ordained the Maoris and the Samoans, the dark-skinned Hawaiians, the Tongans, and other South Sea Islanders, while proclaiming that one who has one drop of Negro blood cannot hold the priesthood. For you see, it is the Negroid flat nose and thick lips with which they disagree. For the past 15 years or so, since the integration movement has been gaining momentum, many intellectual and more liberal Mormons have been clamoring for a new revelation. Negroes in Utah for many years have chafed under the oppression. Several have expressed themselves to me, saying that they felt far more ill at ease and oppressed in Utah than in Mississippi or Alabama. The NAACP finally got together enough people that they marched on the church headquarters in Salt Lake City way back in 1965. They had 250 people who marched on the church headquarters, asking that a statement on civil rights be given. The march was reported on the obituary page of the Mormon newspaper. Sterling McMurrin, who served for a time in the Kennedy or Johnson administration as Commissioner of Education, vigorously spoke out against the LDS position. He was a Mormon from Utah. George Romney, who had been president of American Motors, who had served as governor of the state of Michigan, and who later served as a member of the Nixon cabinet, when he was a candidate for the presidency, expressed himself as being displeased with their position on the Negro. During the 1976 campaign, Morris Udall also spoke rather quietly about his disagreement with the church on this issue. His brother, Stuart Udall, from Arizona, has also made his position known. But Mormon politicians who would hope to reach the rank and file of American voters have had to apologize to the blacks, and to all Americans for that matter, for the adamant position that the LDS Church has taken on this issue. Even athletes from universities with which BYU was scheduled to play sometimes entered into the fray. Arizona and California and Wyoming newspapers often reported on their students who objected to playing with racist BYU. Some universities threatened to break ties with Brigham Young University over the issue. Protests were received from San Jose State, from Stanford, from the University of Wyoming, from the University of Arizona, as they pressed the Mormon Church and Brigham Young University for its uncompromising position on the blacks. And then the magazines got into it. The Look magazine, Time, the New York Times, major books like that by Wallace Turner called The Mormon Establishment, and Life magazine, even the unofficial Mormon magazine called Dialogue, printed articles criticizing the church. Way back in 1968, the Ogden Examiner quoted Mr. McMurrin, the former U.S. Commissioner of Education, as saying, "The Mormon Church will lose tens of thousands of members because it refuses to modify its anti-Negro policies and practices." We must remind you that good Mormons do not pick what they like and reject what they dislike about Mormonism. There is no room in Mormonism for personal conviction. No democratic choice can be made. They had to wait for the president of the church to proclaim a revelation. These old men, some of them in their middle 90s, only one in his 70s, others in their 80s, did not quickly respond to the pleas of their people. Joseph Fielding Smith, who has written more books about Mormonism, I'm sure, than any other man, and who was the grandnephew of Joseph Smith, and who finally, at the age of, I believe, 95, became president of the Mormon Church, wrote some years ago, "I'm getting a little fed up on the idea of so many people who think I am responsible for the Negro not achieving or not getting the priesthood." Though the New York Times had quoted one as saying that top leadership of the Mormon Church is seriously considering the abandonment of its historic policy of discrimination against Negroes. They said this way back in 1963. It was a long time in coming. Hugh B. Brown, then one of the counselors in the first presidency of the LDS Church, said that we are in the midst of a survey looking toward the possibility of admitting Negroes. He said further that the denial of the priesthood will change in the not-too-distant future. But Brigham Young had said that the Negroes would not receive the priesthood until after the second advent of Christ. And while Brown, who was David O. McKay's was in the first presidency of David O. McKay, while he was promising hope, McKay, who outranked him, was saying, when will the Negro receive the priesthood? Not in my lifetime, young man, or yours. John L. Lunn, in his book, The Church and the Negro, had said that the Negro would not be allowed to hold the priesthood during mortality. In fact, not until after the resurrection of Adam's children. And many people have understood that the Negro would not receive the priesthood until after the Jews had come into the church. And Mark E. Peterson, just two heartbeats away from being the Mormon prophet, spoke rather eloquently at BYU some years ago to a convention of teachers of religion on the college level, saying, in essence, that their position was segregation. In no uncertain terms, he sustained the LDS position that Negroes are cursed, that they are not to hold the priesthood. He declared that the black or Negroid features were the mark of Cain's curse. Now, Peterson was not speaking as an individual. He is a ranking member of the 12 apostles of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And when what he said was later printed by a modern microfilm company, Peterson wrote them threatening a lawsuit, but none was forthcoming. This is another example of the way that the Mormon Church has withheld many of its teachings and some of its thinking from outsiders. I would point out that Mark Peterson is currently, on this date in 1978, just one away from the presidency. In other words, Ezra Taft Benson is next to be president of the church, and Mark Peterson is to follow him. Mark Peterson was simply proclaiming the official Mormon position to which they had held for the past 130 years or so. Perhaps I should say something at this point about the fact that several Negroes have helped the Mormon priesthood, some within the past 40 years. LDS officials sometimes admit that Elijah Abel was ordained an elder in March of 1836. Abel's was known by Joseph Smith, and in fact Smith records in his history, in volume 4 and page 365, that when he was arrested, Abel's was among those who sought to rescue him, and it was said that Abel's even lived in his house for a time. But Mormons are hesitate to admit that Elijah Abel's son and grandson were also admitted to the Mormon priesthood. Elijah's son Enoch was ordained an elder in 1900 in the Logan, Utah, 5th Ward. And his son Elijah, a grandson of the earlier Elijah, was ordained a priest in 1934 and an elder in September of 1935 in the Logan, Utah, 10th Ward. So really, the recent hullabaloo about Negroes not receiving the priesthood was somewhat beside the point. A new revelation was not really needed, perhaps. Another facet of this case was the news back in July of 1974 when a suit was brought on behalf of two 12-year-old black Boy Scouts. These boys had been denied advancement to senior patrol leadership positions in the LDS Scout Troop simply because of their race. The Boy Scouts of America were also named in this suit, and they immediately demanded that the LDS Church amend its policy of discrimination in advancement to allow the black boys to attain leadership positions formerly denied them because they were black. The church revised its policy immediately, just hours before the show cause hearings were scheduled in federal court. Therefore, the LDS Church was again found in the position of having to revise its policy because of expediency. Now, if the LDS Church claimed to be no more than a social club, it might well make its policy decisions on the basis of expediency. But when it claims direct revelation from God, when it claims to be able to speak for God, when it claims to possess a prophet and apostles who have the ear of God, and that it alone possesses the power and authority to provide modern-day revelations for its people, then we are concerned. Therefore, for it to submit as it has on these two occasions over polygamy, and in the case of the black Boy Scouts, there is every evidence that the Latter-day Saints Church operates as do other secular institutions, mindful of the thinking of the general public, and according to the handwriting on the wall, when some federal court makes or is about to make some important decision. The recent Utah Historical Quarterly, the winter issue of 1978, has an interesting article on the subject of the black and the LDS priesthood. Its appearance at such a time as this seems almost providential. This rather lengthy article makes several interesting observations. It points out that blacks had one time helped the priesthood, and he names others besides the Abels. He contends that the banning of the Negro from the Mormon priesthood did not date from Joseph Smith or even from the Pearl of Great Price, but that it was actually an evolving process brought about by Brigham Young as a result of the thinking of the people, some of whom were slaveholders, and as a modification of the Mormons' racial self-image as the chosen white people. Those who questioned Brigham's right to leadership were always pictured by him as darkened, inferior, deteriorated people, who were inferior to the fair-faced, self-proclaimed prophet. The leaders from Smith's and Brigham's family, who've remained in charge of Mormonism from its early days in Utah to the present, have kept the idea of lineage as important and a prerequisite to the Mormon priesthood by drawing parallels between rival claimants to Mormon authority as white and black, and by the emphasis on the sons of Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh in their patriarchal blessings. This gradual pride and prejudice for the white race took upon itself the master race concept that has now evolved into a doctrine of white supremacy. I would like to mention that practically every Mormon youth goes to one of the older men in the ward who has been designated as the ward patriarch, or sometimes the stake patriarch. And this old gentleman is somewhat like a fortune teller. He gives them a legal document containing several pages, usually, in which he tells the young man or the young woman something of their promise of the future. And he usually mentions that they were either of the tribe of Manasseh or the tribe of Ephraim. I heard a fellow say not long ago that perhaps 95% of all Mormons who have received their patriarchal blessings have been told that they are either of the tribe of Ephraim or the tribe of Manasseh. Now, Ephraim and Manasseh were the two sons of Joseph. These boys were born in Egypt. I'd like to call your attention to a passage in the 41st chapter of the book of Genesis. The 41st chapter of the book of Genesis, if you would read verses 44 through 52, you would find that Joseph was married to an Egyptian woman, and you will recall that it was the Egyptians that were cursed as to the priesthood. These Egyptians were of the lineage of Ham, and so they were supposed to have borne the curse. So if Mormons today are of the lineage of Ephraim and Manasseh, then they have coursing in their veins the cursed blood, which will not allow them to hold the LDS priesthood. I thought that was rather interesting that even they have found themselves, and maybe that's the reason, because this has been brought out several times recently, maybe that's the reason for the recent proclamation of this new revelation that we've been hearing about these last few weeks. The authors of this volume, the Utah Historical Society Quarterly, point out that even the appearance of Walker Lewis and William McCary, early black leaders in Mormon Utah, must have made quite a splash for a time. And it looked as though many more blacks would be coming into the church. And perhaps this caused Brigham Young to express his belief that the black was ineligible to hold the priesthood. You will find that on page 62 in this Utah Historical Quarterly, and that is the winter 1978 issue. The author of this article observes and concludes that the Mormon priesthood denial did not emerge in a direct, clear-cut manner. It was an ambiguous decision. It was a decision prompted by a number of incidents and trends affecting the church in the 4.5-year period immediately following Joseph Smith's death. Therefore, rather than this teaching coming from God in the first place, the Mormon Negro doctrine was just the natural outcome of a backwoods prejudice and involvement, which leads me to conclude that the proclaimed black revelation wasn't a revelation at all. It wasn't of God in the first place. The black revelation, like the polygamy manifesto and the changing of the scouting policy, was just another very human result of expediency. And this brings us to another interesting aspect of this subject. Perhaps you recall Douglas Wallace, a Portland, Oregon Mormon, who in April of 1976 attempted to force the hand of the LDS president by ordaining a black man, Larry Lester of Vancouver, Washington, into the LDS priesthood. But for his efforts, Mormon leaders declared that the ordination was null and void, and they excommunicated Wallace and obtained a restraining order keeping Wallace off the Salt Lake Temple grounds during that conference period. After several legal attempts to try the Mormon president and to bring charges publicly against the Mormon prophet, it looked as though Wallace was being ignored at the church headquarters. Another Mormon, former Mormon missionary Brian Marchant, cast the first vote in modern history against a Mormon leader in the conference of October 1977. Now, Marchant had simply voted to call attention to what he believed was the improper denial of the priesthood to blacks. His was the only vote cast in the negative. Every April and October, the Mormon prophet, the 12 apostles, the presiding bishopric, other Mormon leaders, their names are offered to the conference to be sustained or upheld. And for many years, everybody has voted to uphold or to sustain these people. And so this man, Marchant, M-A-R-C-H-A-N-T, was the first man in many years to vote negatively. He was immediately excommunicated, and his job as the ward custodian was terminated. The nature of Mormonism is such that there is absolutely no room for any difference of opinion. The LDS Church is not a democracy. The individual has no rights. The system is operated from the top down, and every decision is made by church leaders without regard for the thinking of the membership. At this point, would you turn your cassette over to hear the remainder of our presentation? However, it is obvious that the LDS Church has always been alert to public opinion, and someone has said that they also consider the Dow Jones potential. Actually, the Mormon hierarchy is much more alert to the thinking of influential political leaders outside the church than they are of the rank and the file inside it. Perhaps it is much more sensitive to expediency than it is to God. I have been asked several times since the revelation was given, "What do you think about it?" Some have said, "Isn't it wonderful?" Or they've said, "I've been hoping for this for a long time." Some of the more liberal theologians have been asked, and they speak as though this is a great thing. Some of the civil rights leaders have been asked, and they have made their remarks that they think this is a great day for the blacks. I must submit that I have no such feelings. I have expected it, to be sure. It was only a matter of time. In a way, I'm rather surprised that they waited this long. I would not have been surprised if it had not come for some years yet. I really did not expect it exactly when it came. But it was a wise move. It had to come sooner or later, and it's coming just when it did, when there was no uproar about it, when there was a lull in the efforts that were being made by those who campaigned for it, when that made its pronouncement most opportune. But I'm convinced that the timing was planned to divert the thinking and the media from the full impact of the announcement that the so-called Mormon will had been declared a fraud. Now, you recall the Mormon will that was found on one of the upper floors of the church office building in Salt Lake City. Later it was learned that the young man who was supposed to have met Howard Hughes out in the desert and to have befriended him and given him a quarter to make a telephone call And he told the story of how this will was later delivered to him, and finally he admitted that he had delivered it to the LDS Church. We have not felt that the will could be a proper one. We didn't think it could possibly have been a legitimate will. But evidently the church felt that there was some possibility. They had employed lawyers, and for weeks they had been in Las Vegas attempting to prove their right to about $150 million. And this announcement was made just hours before the Mormon revelation was announced. To me, it came at a perfect time. It pushed the Mormon will news clear off the front page. And the news continued to be to take precedent over the will story for several days. Actually, it took precedent until finally the will news was no news at all, and the idea was dropped. So it seems to me that what was done was simply taking advantage of the opportunity to divert the thinking of Mormon people who would be lamenting the fact that the church had spent all this money for lawyers, and the church had acted as though it thought that this was the last will and testament of Howard Hughes. And now they would have been talking about the fact that they lost all this money, but here comes the will, the revelation, the first real revelation in 121 years, and it served to completely divert the thinking of the LDS people and many others in Utah too, I'm sure. Now, what would be the result of the Mormons granting the priesthood to the blacks? I expect to hear that there will be a great upsurge in the number of blacks joining the church. I would hope that Negroes would look with skepticism on such a move. Though the church is bound by the decision of its prophet, I know Mormonism well enough to know that the average Mormon in Utah is a proverbial redneck, and that a mere edict will not change the thinking and preaching of more than 100 years. I commented recently that I would hope that 5,000 Negroes would call upon the Chamber of Commerce in Salt Lake City, that they'd be looking for housing within a few days of the announcement of this revelation, and that they would check with the federal and state and local employment agencies inquiring about jobs, and that they would inquire at both the government and the church welfare offices asking about welfare services. That would be bedlam. I could only imagine the resulting confusion. Racial prejudices are not easily forgotten, and I predict that the blacks' hopes for equality in Utah will be a long, long time in coming. You see, I began my observation of this new revelation with some conclusions that may, in the emotion of the moment, be forgotten. The Mormon doctrine of the black was not God-given in the first place. Its doctrine was simply the result of purely human prejudices and thinking. I can stand off and view this event objectively and without emotion. As I see it, neither good or bad, per se, has been accomplished. I dread to see a rich and powerful and prestigious organization take advantage of the thousands of humble, God-fearing, sincere black people. There will be people in hell because of this imposture. The devil is wise. He takes every advantage possible. And in this instance, the revelation is bad. I do not see the civil rights aspects of this case to be of value. Any study of Mormon pronouncements on the Negro must lead one to see that this revelation is not a change in their opinion of the Negro, or a change in their theology. It's not even a change in their thinking that the black is the mark of the curse. They haven't changed that. They've simply said, we're going to allow them to hold the priesthood. It seems to me that the new revelation is a ploy to gain political favor and to add numbers of blacks to their increasing list of tithe payers. I see this revelation as another instance where political expediency has overshadowed the Mormon prophet. I believe Mr. Kimball heard that instead of God. This revelation has been a long time in coming. The question has been, where and when shall we spring this bombshell on our people? Where will it result in the least problem, or how can it best be used to our advantage? The polygamy issue closely parallels this one. On the one hand, preachers and politicians were clamoring for an end to polygamy. May I point out here that polygamy is probably more responsible for the success of Mormonism today as we know it than any other single thing. At a time when there were no nationwide newspapers, at a time when there was no transcontinental railroad, at a time when there was no radio and no television, it would seem impossible for a poor group such as Mormons were, way off out in the middle of the western section of this United States, it would seem impossible that they could get an advantage of getting their names and their thinking on the tongue of every people. But within a short time, preachers were preaching on it. Attention was called in practically every church service. The congressman, the president of the United States, the judges. This was a common subject of discussion. And so polygamy served to make it possible for Mormonism to attain the position that it has now. And I believe that there is a possibility that the Mormon Church will make some kind of a gain from this so-called revelation. Mormons responded back in the days of polygamy by saying that you could just as easily move the sun and the moon as change our teaching on polygamy. They said that polygamy is as important to our teaching as baptism or the Lord's Supper. They said, and let me quote, "There are, however, enough witnesses to these principles to establish them," and he was talking about eternal marriage and plural marriage, "to establish them upon the earth in such a manner that they never will be stamped out, for they will live, they are destined to live, and also to grow and to spread abroad upon the face of the earth, to be received and accepted and adopted by all the virtuous, by all the pure in heart, by all who love the truth and seek to serve Him and keep His commandments. And they, eternal marriage and plural marriage, are bound to prevail because they are true principles." That was printed in the Journal of Discourses, Volume 21, and on page 10. But just 10 years later, after the government had confiscated their money and property, and in order that they might be able to attain statehood, the Mormon Church capitulated. They got the manifesto, and though they never gave up the principle of polygamy, they dared not openly flaunt their teachings as they once did. Now, of course, I'm aware that the Mormon missionaries, as they go from house to house, are leaving the impression with our people that polygamy is no longer being taught by the Mormons. They're very careful to use that expression. They don't tell you they don't believe it, but they say it's not being practiced or it's not being taught. But the principle of polygamy has not been changed. They still believe as they did before. Now, nearly 90 years later, the LDS church leaders have again found themselves with their backs against the wall. Negroes have been demanding their rights. Brigham Young University was in trouble. Other schools were refusing to play ball with them. Mormon political candidates were finding their church's Negro position an embarrassment. Unrelenting pressure welled up from time to time, in a crescendo that demanded response. Those of us who observe Mormonism have predicted for years that the announcement had to come. The only question was when. I think they found the opportune time, a time when nobody was really pressing, a time when it seemed to have died down just a little bit, a time when the Mormon will had just been found to be a fraud, and a need to change the thinking of the media and its people. This is just another proof that Mormonism is not what it claims to be. It is expediency-oriented and motivated. Its teachings are man-made. It assumes a godly stance and evidences a pious countenance, but it really is just a man-made organization claiming divine origin. Mormonism claims to know all the answers. From time to time in its turbulent 150-year history, it has found itself in trouble. Each time, piously, it maneuvers itself into the position of gaining the greatest advantage and experiencing the least difficulty. It knows why some are dark-skinned and others are light. It knows that the Garden of Eden was really located in Missouri. It knows that Noah's Ark came to rest in the Carolinas. It knows that where the city of Enoch is. It knows where the lost tribes are. It knows that the moon is inhabited. It seems that our astronauts just haven't made contact with them yet. It knows that a godmother is in heaven as well as a godfather. It knows that Christ was married to several women simultaneously and that they bore him children. It knows that polygamy is superior to monogamy, and it knew why Negroes were black. And its leaders preached for 100 years that they were unworthy of the priesthood until one day in 1978 when their prophet got a revelation. Somebody called it Black Friday. Black Friday. It might be called Black Friday for a number of reasons. It might have been called Black Friday because that was the day the blacks could hold the priesthood. But I think it might be called a Black Friday because other well-meaning, sincere, well-intentioned, earnest people may be drawn into great error. To me, for me, I just can't buy it. My God doesn't deal that way. My God made the earth, and He made it out of nothing. My God made the earth and made man out of the dust of the earth and put man here and gave him a responsibility. And God allowed man to have everything in the Garden of Eden with the exception of the fruit of just one tree. My things were good for man. But man was not satisfied with all that he had. He wanted the little something more. You know, Mormonism would tell us that God forced Adam to sin. Mormonism would tell us that there was a higher law, that of having children. And when Adam found his wife Eve outside the garden because she had eaten of the forbidden fruit, he, in his wisdom, he didn't sin, they say. He only transgressed. He, in his wisdom, willfully ate of the forbidden fruit, in order to get himself put out of the garden too, so that they would be able to have children. One of the few passages in the Book of Mormon that is contradictory to Scripture is the passage that says Adam sinned that men might be, and men are that they might have joy. In other words, God forced Adam to sin. I cannot buy that kind of an idea. I'm convinced that man chose to sin, and men choose to sin today. But God loved man. He loved him so much that he was willing to come himself in order to redeem him. He was willing to come as none had ever come before, to die on the cross, to take man's place, to become our substitute, to make it possible for men by simple faith to believe and to trust. and to become gods by a new birth relationship. I would call your attention very briefly to a passage in the third chapter of the book of John. In this passage we are told, in verse 18, "He that believeth on him is not condemned, but he that believeth not is condemned already, because he hath not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God." Now, Mormonism would tell you that you need to know your genealogy so that you would know who to be baptized on behalf of, and so you would know who to be married on behalf of, so that you could provide for the members of your family that had not had the opportunity to be a part of Mormonism. Mormonism would appear to have all the answers. Friend, I don't think it's a matter of the color of your skin. I don't think it's a matter of your ancestry, but I believe it's a matter of simple faith and trust in the Lord Jesus. This passage that I read says, "He that believeth on him is not condemned, but he that believeth not is condemned already." I thank God that in his own due time, he allowed me to come to this earth. And I can't agree that I was born up in heaven and that I ran around all over God's heaven waiting for an opportunity to come here and to enter my mother's womb and to be born as a baby in order that I might continue my progress toward Godhood. I do not understand that the Bible teaches such. But one day, I came to understand that it was not enough that I had tried hard to live a good, clean, moral life. That it was not enough that my mother and my father loved me. That it was not enough that they too were upright and honorable people. That it was not enough that they had been born into the white race, but that I needed something more. And one day I came to understand that Christ was the one who had made it possible for me to be saved, and I am so happy that I made my decision back yonder. And if you have not made that peace with God, I would appeal to you today that you would let Christ come into your heart and into your life. He alone has the power to save. He alone can make you right in his sight. And I would hope that you would trust him today. If you would like other information on Mormonism, we have a number of tapes. We have a number of books. We have some tracts and other materials. We also have some materials prepared by other people that we make available to those who would want them. I would invite you to write to me. My name is John L. Smith, Box 47, Marlow, spelled M-A-R-L-O-W, Marlow, Oklahoma. If you would like another copy of this tape, you may receive it by simply sending your name and address along with $4 as a contribution to our ministry, and we'll be happy to provide the new tape for you.